Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A deal has been reached with the government of Syria to reopen the main border crossing from Turkey to allow the delivery of humanitarian aid. For the next 6 months, the Bab al-Hawa border crossing will be accessible and allow much-needed assistance to reach millions of people in northwest Syria. Bab al-Hawa has been used since 2014 when the Security Council authorized cross-border relief deliveries across conflict lines. Around 85% of aid deliveries have passed through Bab al-Hawa from Turkey since then. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres welcomed the decision following talks between UN Humanitarian Chief Martin Griffiths and Syrian government officials, said UN Deputy Spokesperson Farhan Haq. The development comes after an initial attempt to renew the agreement at the UN Security Council failed after a veto from Russia. The agreement also involved authorization from the UN to use the Bab al-Salam and al-Raiya border crossings for an additional 3 months, which originally opened earlier this year as part of the emergency response to the earthquake disaster that hit Syria and Turkey in February. According to Mr. Griffiths, over 12 years of conflict, economic collapse, the earthquake, and other factors have pushed 90% of the population in Syria below the poverty line. To mark the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki 78 years ago, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has urged global powers to eradicate the use of nuclear weapons. Calling for no more Nagasakis, the UN chief said that the only way to eliminate the danger was to eliminate nuclear weapons. Some 70,000 people died in the Nagasaki bombing, devastation that Mr. Guterres said must never again be allowed to happen, as he insisted that the elimination of nuclear weapons was the UN's highest disarmament priority. His message echoes that of the UN's new Agenda for Peace, launched in July this year, which calls on states to urgently recommit to pursuing a world free of nuclear weapons and to reinforce global norms against their use. In his message to the Nagasaki Peace Memorial, the Secretary-General said that we will not sit idly by as nuclear-armed states race to create even more dangerous weapons. His comments come as talks in Vienna continue this week on the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the international agreement aimed at strengthening global rules on disarmament and non-proliferation. Following a week-long suspension of services in Ain al-Hilwa camp after armed clashes, the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, has now resumed operations. The UN agency that's dedicated to supporting Palestinian refugees reopened a health center in the southern Lebanese camp and resumed provision of medical care to patients, including to newborns in need of treatment and vaccinations. Director of UNRWA Lebanon, Dorothy Klaus, said that families had been under fire and unable to leave their houses for days and then injured upon escape. A secure environment is necessary for the UN agency to operate, the UNRWA official insisted. The agency has started the removal of conflict remnants from affected parts of the camp, following more than 2 days of armed violence between Palestinian groups last week, which left 13 people dead and more than 60 injured. Located near the city of Saida, the camp is the largest of 12 Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. It shut down last week as shelling and artillery fire reached commercial and residential areas, forcing over 2,000 people to flee. Caitlin Kelly, UN News.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 36 people have died on the Hawaiian island of Maui as unprecedented wind-driven wildfires forced thousands of people to flee their homes. Hospitals have been overwhelmed with burned patients. Some people had to run into the ocean to escape the flames. Much of the town of Lahaina has burned to the ground. Lahaina was once the capital of the Hawaiian kingdom. Residents described horrific scenes of destruction.
A resident of Lahaina
for about 18 years, and we just had the worst disaster I've ever seen. All line is burnt to crisp, and it's like an apocalypse.
The fires began on Tuesday and rapidly spread as wind from Hurricane Dora, hundreds of miles away, and dry conditions fueled the blaze. This is Hawaii's Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke.
You know, the point is, a lot of residents in the state of Hawaii, when we are preparing for the hurricane, we expect rain. Sometimes we expect floods. We never anticipated in this state that a hurricane, which did not make impact on our islands, will cause this type of wildfires. Wildfires that wiped out communities, wildfires that wiped out businesses, wildfires that destroyed homes.
Ecuador has declared a state of emergency following the assassination of the presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio. The former journalist was fatally shot after a campaign event in Quito 10 days before the August 20th election. He'd faced death threats recently for speaking out about the links between the government and organized crime. This is Fernando Villavicencio speaking in late July.
The country knew through the media of a police report in which it's revealed a very serious threat of one of the Sinaloa cartel's boss. I'm referring to alias Tito against me and my campaign team. There was this warning that if I keep referring to him and his structure, they would attack me or my life.
Los narcotraficantes y las mafias quieren tomarse el poder.
Drug traffickers and the mafia want to take the political power of the state, and without a doubt, it's not Tito who's behind this threat. It's the political mafias that are behind Tito who is behind this threat against my candidacy.
Fernando Villavicencio was 59 years old. The BBC reports a criminal group called Los Lobos, meaning the wolves, has claimed responsibility for his murder. One suspect was shot dead after the assassination. President Biden's reportedly planning to seek an additional $25 billion from Congress to be spent partly on the war in Ukraine, as well as to speed up weapons delivery to Taiwan. This comes as the war in Ukraine continues to intensify. On Thursday, a massive blast at a factory outside Moscow injured 56 people. Meanwhile, Poland has announced plans to send an additional 10,000 troops to its border with Belarus. Niger's new military leaders are accusing France of trying to destabilize the country by releasing captured terrorists and breaching its airspace. France has denied the claims. This comes as ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, is holding an emergency summit today in Nigeria. ECOWAS has threatened to use military force to remove Niger's military leaders who seized power in a coup 2 weeks ago. After headlines, we'll speak with Syracuse University professor Horace Campbell. In Pakistan, the imprisoned former Prime Minister Imran Khan has filed an appeal days after he was sentenced to 3 years in prison on corruption charges. Earlier this week, Pakistan's election commission barred Khan from politics for 5 years. Pakistan's parliament removed Khan from office in April 2022. On Wednesday, The Intercept revealed the existence of a classified Pakistani cable that outlined how the U.S. State Department had encouraged the Pakistani government to remove Khan from office in March of 2022, just weeks after Russia had invaded Ukraine. The document stated the U.S. objected to Khan's neutral stance on the war. According to the memo, one State Department official warned Pakistan's ambassador to the United States that, quote, all will be forgiven in Washington if Khan is removed. The U.S. official, Assistant Secretary of State Donald Liu, then went on to say, quote, otherwise I think it will be tough going ahead, he said. The death toll from a migrant shipwreck off Tunisia's coast has risen to at least 41, including 3 children. The ship capsized and sank just a few hours after departing from Europe. Dozens are still missing from another shipwreck near the Tunisian port city of Sfax. The number of asylum seekers fleeing from Tunisia has dramatically increased in recent months due to the persecution of black Africans by Tunisian authorities and President Kais Saied. On Wednesday, at least 27 people were found dead in the desert after they were expelled from Tunisia. This is a pregnant asylum seeker who was expelled from Tunisia.
I was in Tunisia. My husband is a day laborer. We wanted to go to Italy and there was beating and insults. After that, 2 days ago, they took us to the borders. The following day, after we reached the borders, they took us, beat the men and left us. We walked on the road towards Libya, but we don't know the direction. We walked for 3-4 hours. Then the Libyan police found us.
Venezuela has won a major legal battle to recover about $1.5 billion that have been confiscated by the Portuguese bank Novo Banco, which is largely owned by the U.S. private equity firm Lone Star. For years, the Venezuelan government has decried international sanctions that has led to foreign banks freezing its overseas assets. In 2021, The Intercept reported Venezuela was blocked from using some of the money held by the bank to buy millions of vaccines for children. President Biden signed an executive order to ban U.S. firms from investing in Chinese high-tech companies developing semiconductors and quantum computers. The Chinese government criticized the move, accusing the U.S. of politicizing and weaponizing trade and technological issues. Newly unsealed court documents show Special Counsel Jack Smith obtained a search warrant to access Donald Trump's Twitter account as part of the investigation into Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Twitter, now known as X, was fined $350,000 after initially refusing to hand over Trump's personal data. Meanwhile, CNN is reporting Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in Georgia is expected to seek more than a dozen indictments next week in her probe on Trump's efforts to overturn the election in Georgia. Security around Willis has increased after Trump attacked her on the campaign trail, calling her a racist while spreading rumors about her. Bonnie Willis is the first black woman to serve as Fulton County District Attorney. The FBI shot and killed a Utah man who threatened the life of President Biden. The shooting came on Wednesday morning as the FBI attempted to serve the man, Craig Robertson, an arrest and search warrant. Robertson had posted numerous online threats targeting Biden and other officials. He recently wrote he was cleaning the dust off his M24 sniper rifle after learning Biden would be in Utah today. He was killed in Utah. CNN is reporting the former head of the U.S. Coast Guard covered up the results of an explosive investigation into decades of rape and sexual assault at the Coast Guard's prestigious academy. 4 years ago, Commandant Carl Schultz and his Deputy Admiral Charles Ray suppressed the report as investigators were set to brief lawmakers and the Homeland Security Department on its findings. The current head of the Coast Guard, Linda Fagan, has acknowledged she'd become aware of the report and its cover-up, but has vowed to tackle sexual assault at the agency. Fagan, who's the Coast Guard's first female leader, has also apologized to survivors. ProPublica has revealed new details about how conservative billionaires have showered Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas with free trips and gifts for decades. ProPublica's new report documents 38 destination vacations, 26 private jet flights, 12 VIP passes to sporting events, and 8 helicopter flights, all paid for by billionaire patrons. Thomas has been under increasing scrutiny since April when ProPublica revealed he'd failed to report frequent luxury trips paid for by the billionaire Harlan Crowe. And the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem is reporting 86 members of a Palestinian Bedouin community have been forced to abandon their homes due to violent threats from Israeli settlers. This is Mohammed Hassan Abu Akbash of the Bedouin community Akabun.
We've lived here for 20, 25 years. We're farmers, shepherds, and we've lived here normally with our flock. But a settler came to the area and started making trouble for us. They tell us, don't graze here. You're not allowed to graze there. These are my lands. A few days ago, they spilled my neighbor's sheep's drinking water on the ground. 2 days ago, an armed settler came, walked around our home, came inside, and just sat there. He says the land is his. He says, I'm the government. I'm the state. I'm the police and the military. It's come to the point where we're leaving. It's a done deal.
According to B'Tselem, the Bedouin community Al-Kabun is the fourth Palestinian community forced to abandon its land in the last 3 months due to threats from Israeli settlers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about a week of action that Reporters Without Borders organized in defense of Julian Assange.
We talk to Clayton Weimers, who discusses the threats to press freedom worldwide. And we speak with Paul Cox, who has worked for years to gain compensation for the victims of Agent Orange, the deadly chemical sprayed by the U.S. military on the people and land of Vietnam.
Paul works with the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign.
Stay with us. I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Facing the possibility of WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange's imminent extradition to the United States, Reporters Without Borders recently launched a week of advocacy meetings and a mobile truck through the streets of Washington, D.C. to urgently call for his release. The actions were organized after UK High Court Judge Jonathan Swift, in June, rejected Julian Assange's appeal against the UK's order of extradition to the United States. Assange, who is being targeted for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes, is the first publisher prosecuted under the Espionage Act for disclosing government secrets. He faces a maximum sentence of 175 years in prison. Rebecca Vincent, director of campaigns for Reporters Without Borders, said, quote, U.S. policymakers still have the power and the opportunity to make a difference in this case and to take a stand for the protection of journalism and press freedom. Our call on the Biden administration is more urgent than ever before. Drop the charges, close this case, and free Assange. Reporters Without Borders is the only non-governmental organization to have monitored Assange's entire extradition proceedings, despite extensive barriers to observation. In April 2023, its Secretary General Christophe Deloire and Rebecca Vincent were arbitrarily barred from visiting Julian Assange in Belmarsh Prison, where he's been held for more than 4 years. Reporters Without Borders continues to seek access to the prison and to campaign globally for Assange's release. We're delighted today to welcome Clayton Weimers, Executive Director of the U.S. Office of Reporters Without Borders. Clayton was previously the organization's Washington-based Deputy Director for Advocacy. Clayton, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
You've asked the Biden administration to lead by example in the global defense of press freedom by dismissing the case against Julian Assange. What will it mean for press freedom internationally if this prosecution continues and Assange is convicted?
Well, it sets a really dangerous precedent, and that's, you know, in addition to the international aspect, I'll start by saying the precedent that it would set here in this country. Julian Assange is being charged under 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act, and that is unprecedented. No publisher in American history has ever been charged with violation of the Espionage Act. When we think about what that would mean for the future of the free press in the United States, it's not hard to imagine future administrations cracking down on an unfriendly media by using similar tactics to go after any news publication, any journalistic source. The Espionage Act is a World War I era archaic law that is really overly broadly applied in this case and has no business being used to go against any sort of publishing or media. So it's important to separate that principle from what anyone might think of Julian Assange, the man, or the public figure, because really what's at stake here is nothing short of how we understand press freedom and the freedom from government interference. Now, as far as the international implications, you know, we already feel them every day. I know that anytime the United States government is talking to authoritarian regimes and encouraging them to respect human rights, it's always thrown back in their face. What about Julian Assange? It's coming up right now in negotiations with the Kremlin over the fate of Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter who's currently imprisoned in Russia. The Kremlin frequently says, well, what about Julian Assange? And, you know, while we don't necessarily take all of these whataboutisms at face value with authoritarian regimes, it is nevertheless the case that the United States is really out of step with international opinion on this case.
Clayton, you organized a truck to drive through Washington, D.C. on July 17th to mobilize public support for Julian's freedom. What was the response to that action in the streets?
The most telling response we got was when a woman walked up to us and asked us what that video that we were showing was. And when we explained it to her, she said, and I think I'm quoting her exactly, nobody knows what that is. Well, that is perfectly encapsulates why we're out here. This case has been going on for 12 years now. Julian Assange has been a prisoner for over 4 years in the UK. But at its core, people don't have a good understanding of what this case is about or what's been going on. And that really suits the governments involved just fine. They would prefer people are not paying attention to this case, because the more you dig into it, the less flattering it makes the case that the government presents. Look, that's one of our motivations for attempting stunts like that truck and making videos and showing the collateral murder video, is to bring more attention to this case that has really fallen out of the public spotlight. And it highlights that there's more work for groups like us to do to keep it at the front of mind. There's also a lot more work for the media to do here. You know, I think a lot of great media organizations produced a lot of excellent journalism on the basis of WikiLeaks revelations. And it's disappointing to not see that same level of commitment applied to defending the source of that information, which was the publisher Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. So, you know, the response that we got sort of reiterated how important it is for us to keep this case front of mind.
And you're referring to the so-called collateral murder video. Can you briefly remind listeners what that was and how you explain it to passersby like that woman?
Sure. You know, just very briefly, the collateral murder video was one of many things exposed by the WikiLeaks publication. But in this case, it was a video of an American helicopter gunship gunning down civilians outside of Baghdad, including two Reuters journalists. And so what we have here is the clear evidence of a war crime being committed in Iraq. If that is not information that's in the public interest, then I don't know what it is.
Yes, it's a very disturbing video, Clayton, and it also contains evidence of additional violations of the Geneva Conventions and the Army Field Manual, where the gunship continued to fire on people going to rescue the wounded, and then a U.S. Jeep drove over a dead body, defacing that body. It's, people really ought to watch that, because it's startling.
Yeah, and it also exposes as a lie the explanation that was given by the Pentagon in the aftermath of that incident, which said that the rules of engagement were followed. But if you watch the video and you read the Department of Defense's rules of engagement, they were not followed at all.
Right, that's correct. You met with U.S. lawmakers, and your team met with U.S. lawmakers, and they tried to justify the continued persecution of Julian Assange. What was their position?
Now, to be clear, that's not the case for every lawmaker we met with. We have found quite a few allies, especially on Capitol Hill. Eight members of Congress sent a letter earlier this year to the Department of Justice and to the Biden administration asking them to drop the charges. So we do have friends on this issue. We also suspect that there are a large number of lawmakers who are sympathetic but are a little cautious about speaking out. And again, that's why I say it's always important to separate Julian Assange, the person, from the principle that's at play here. We've had this you know, clear up a lot of myths, a lot separating a lot of fact from fiction on this case, that even some of the most well-informed people don't necessarily have all the facts straight on this case. So things like making it clear that this has nothing to do with the 2016 hack of the DNC that was allegedly ascribed to Julian Assange, or that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks themselves did not hack these and steal these documents themselves. They merely published them. One fact that I think is really underreported is that it was never even the intention of WikiLeaks to widely publish the unredacted material in the first place. It really happened as a sort of mistake. A book that was published accidentally included the password to the full unredacted documents in its index. And some months later, a small independent German media outlet was able to figure out what that password was going to unlock and let WikiLeaks know that they were going to publish the full unredacted documents. Julian Assange, to his credit, immediately called the White House and the State Department and warned them weeks in advance of the publication and let them know, look, you know, WikiLeaks obtained these documents. We're not going to be the only ones that aren't going to publish them. So once the cat's out of the bag, we will publish as well. But you need to know. This effectively gave the government time to move key assets out of the way if they thought they would be in danger from the publication, which undermines one of the government's central claims throughout this entire case, is that WikiLeaks harmed the national security through this publication. If that were the case, why did they get the warning ahead of time? If it were also the case, surely at this point we would have had some specifics on what aspects of national security were harmed. In the 12 years that this case has been ongoing, the government has failed to produce a single piece of evidence that shows a concrete national security interest of the United States was harmed, other than a nebulous reputational cost. Maybe that is something that could come out in open court here in the U.S. It hasn't come out in the trials in London so far, but it's a little curious that, you know, no comments have been made on or off the record to the media to justify this prosecution on national security grounds. It's just sort of an article of faith that's asserted but never backed up.
All excellent points. The United States ranks 45th out of 180 countries in Reporters Without Borders World Press Freedom Index. How is that index compiled? And what does that ranking say generally about the United States' respect for freedom of the press?
The index is compiled painstakingly throughout the year, so we collect data on violations of press freedom all over the world in 180 different countries, and so we're doing something as simple as counting up the number of journalists who are arrested or detained, killed or kidnapped anywhere in the world. And we keep a running tally of that on our website, rsf.org, that anyone can go and break it down by country if they like. But what we also do is we have a network of respondents, press freedom experts, so to speak, who fill out a questionnaire that let us get at some of the harder to quantify questions, the qualitative aspects that define whether or not a country has a free press or not, things that are a little tougher to get just counting up data points. And so we have a very impressive roster of experts on the media in 180 different countries, and we survey them as well. We put all of that data together to come up with the score. All of the methodology is publicly available on rsf.org, and so anyone can take a look and see exactly how we do it if they want to get into the nitty-gritty of it. I will also note it's constantly a work in progress. We're always trying to refine the data that we're collecting so that we're getting the most holistic representation of press freedom around the world. So to answer the second part of your question, what does it mean for the United States to be 45th out of 180 countries? A lot of people are shocked to learn that the United States is that low. One of the things I do when I address a new group of people on behalf of RSF is I love to have Americans guess where does the U.S. fall on the rankings, and inevitably they're about 20 to 30 spots off. The truth is that we have a long way to go on a lot of aspects of press freedom, especially for the country that, you know, first enshrined press freedom directly into its constitution in the First Amendment. It's not any one thing, but, you know, in the past year, two journalists were killed in the course of their work in the United States. We've seen an uptick in arrests of journalists in the past couple of years, especially during the Black Lives Matter protests, though we've seen those numbers come down a little bit lately. We also have, you know, a pretty concerning economic situation for journalists in this country. It's difficult to make your living as a reporter. The money is just not there. The consolidation of the media industry is also very concerning to us. You know, we have vanishingly few independent owners of major media organizations. And you just put all of these things together along with a legal framework that still needs to catch up to a lot of the countries that are stronger on protecting press freedom. You take all those factors together and it means we're sort of in this middling position at 45th.
I, Marjorie Cohn, and my co-host Heidi Boghossian are talking to Clayton Wymers from Reporters Without Borders about how the U.S. prosecution of Julian Assange threatens press freedom worldwide. Clayton, the U.S. fell three places in this year's index. U.S. respondents were negative about the current environment for journalists. Please explain the increasing threat to journalists in the United States.
Sure. And I always caution anyone not to look too closely at a drop of, say, three places in the rankings as anything more than the status quo was maintained. You know, three spots in the rankings is as much about other countries moving up as it is about the United States moving down. But the real story is that things have not really improved. We saw a real uptick in hostility against journalists during the Trump administration when we had a president who was openly calling the media the enemy of the people from the pulpit of the White House. You know, that really set things back. It also created, or rather exacerbated, a sense of distrust in the media that's been growing in recent years. You know, a lot of people expected the United States to perform better on the index after we changed presidential administrations. And while rhetorically things have improved in the White House, we haven't really addressed any of the substantive concerns that drive that low score. So just to give one example, the United States currently lacks a federal press shield law. What that would do is ensure that law enforcement can't compel journalists to give up their sources. There was a big push to pass the Press Act, which is exactly that, a press shield law, last year, but it failed to be included in the omnibus at the very last minute. That push is happening again this year. I am personally very optimistic about it. We've been having meetings on the Hill with senators and with members of Congress about it. It has already cleared the House, and so all that's left is to push it through the Senate, and we are hopeful to get that done this year. And I can't promise anything, but I think that would single-handedly improve the press freedom score, because this is not just a philosophical exercise when we're talking about protecting journalistic sources. The former president at multiple campaign rallies now has publicly said he wants to lock up the journalist who broke the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision because they won't give up their source in the Supreme Court. So yeah, it's not a theoretical exercise. This is something that could really happen if we don't have the legal protections in place.
Clayton, the 2023 index highlights the impact of fake news on press freedom. You sort of started to talk about this, but can you touch on the irony between this new trend and the prosecution of Assange for publishing material of interest to the public?
That's a great point. Julian Assange is being prosecuted for publishing 100% correct information. None of it was made up. None of it was doctored. None of it was embellished. It is simply leaked diplomatic cables and war logs. And the truth is, fake news really impacts the legitimate news a great deal, because it helps drive the general distrust in the media, because the general public is increasingly faced with the dilemma of what to believe is true. The average citizen can't necessarily be expected to be an expert in discerning truth from fiction online. It incredibly difficult, even for the most informed people. It's clear we need global solutions that are going to tackle this problem rather than what we have right now, which is effectively outsourcing it to a handful of companies that control the digital town square, so to speak. So, you know, I think everyone has come to realize in the past year or so that we can't rely on a company like Twitter to simply police its platform and to make sure it's free of misinformation. I think most Americans would also agree that we don't want the government to be in the business of telling everyone what is true and what is false. So what we need are independent, democratic safeguards in place to govern the digital space.
Clayton, in the 2023 World Press Freedom Index, threats to press freedom are very serious in 31 countries, difficult in 42, and problematic in 55. It's good or satisfactory in only 52 countries. If Julian Assange is extradited, stands trial, and found guilty of violating the Espionage Act, how do you think that will affect these standings?
It's pretty much impossible to say how it will affect the standings. I will say, as far as the U.S.'s press freedom score goes, the prosecution of Julian Assange is largely baked in already because it's been ongoing, and we take that into account. So the only significant change that could come from there is if the administration decides to drop the charges and allow Julian Assange to go free. But the real story here is that more countries than ever before since we started measuring are falling into that dark red category on our map. And if your listeners go to rsf.org, they can see our map of the world that breaks down every country according to its press freedom score. 31 countries are in the worst situation now, very serious, more than ever before. There's a deterioration of press freedom, especially in authoritarian countries around the world. Part of that is because of this thing we talk about a lot called a culture of impunity. Democratic countries have really failed to step up and impose penalties on the bad actors of the world for targeting journalists. When the Saudi regime is able to order the hit of an American columnist in Jamal Khashoggi, dismember his body in a consulate, and get away with it without suffering any real consequences. So when authoritarian countries are able to say to themselves, look, we're not going to suffer any real consequences by attacking, arresting, or even killing journalists, there's very little standing in their way of doing it. So the democratic countries of the world need to use every tool at their disposal, whether that's international institutions, whether that's bilateral relationships, in order to pressure countries to behave better. It's telling that as Russia has cracked down on its own domestic free press and basically chased all independent media out of the country, what's left for them to do? It's to go after foreign press. And we see that in the detention of Evan Gershkovich. If you look at the criminal complaint against him, he's being accused of collecting information of vital importance to the war effort. That's what journalism is. He's being accused of doing journalism, but the Kremlin considers genuine journalism to be espionage.
That's fascinating. Clayton, we just have a few minutes remaining. I just wanted to note that I understand you and your partners are working to create a charter, an international committee, and a charter aimed at regulating the use of artificial intelligence in the media. Can you briefly tell us about that before we wind up?
Sure. And I'm not directly working on that. That's the work of some of my colleagues in our Paris headquarters. But one thing is clear.
And I think, everyone understands this at this point, that AI is coming for all of us in ways that we can't predict. But one way we can be reasonably sure that it's going to affect us is how we
share and obtain information. And that's going to have a clear, direct effect on journalists, on the media, on news organizations. If we're not careful, if we don't set up rules of the game before it's too late, there's a real risk that AI could do irreparable damage to the field of journalism. There's already some obvious questions like, how are journalists going to be compensated for the fact that AI will essentially use the work that they created to create its own version of a story? How do we work that out? how do we work out, you know, what stories can be AI generated and which ones need to have a human touch? How can reporters use AI, you know, in tandem with, you know, human reporting in order to enhance their stories? Because there are, you know, genuinely a lot of opportunities for AI in journalism, particularly I think of, you know, data journalism. Reporters who have to sift through vast amounts of information are going to benefit greatly from being able to use AI to analyze patterns and, say, look for the story that the numbers are hiding. I think back to, say, the Panama Papers when they were released recently. If you had an AI algorithm plugged in to all of that data, how many more stories would journalists have been able to generate about financial malfeasance that is, you know, very complicated for a few overworked and underpaid journalists to suss out?
Clayton, we're out of time, but can you briefly tell our listeners how to follow your work and that of Reporters Without Borders that's so important?
Sure. Anyone can go to rsf.org. That's our French acronym, Reporters Sans Frontières, because we were founded in Paris. But these days we are a global organization with 13 offices around the world and a network of 150 correspondents covering just about every country on the planet. And so I just represent our DC office that covers North America. You can also follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter.
Clayton, this has been fascinating, and we were delighted to be able to fit into your busy schedule. Thank you so much for your important work and for joining us as a guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Clayton.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Although the Vietnam War ended in 1975, Vietnamese people today continue to suffer the debilitating effects of Agent Orange. That's the deadly dioxin-containing chemical weapon that the U.S. military sprayed over 12% of South Vietnam from 1961 to 1971. Agent Orange poisoned both the people and the land of Vietnam. On August 10th, known as Agent Orange Day, we mark the 63rd anniversary of the first spraying of the toxic chemical on Vietnam. Descendants of the roughly 2 to 4 million Vietnamese people, hundreds of thousands of U.S. Vietnam veterans, and Vietnamese Americans exposed to Agent Orange and other toxins still suffer. They register disproportionate rates of congenital disabilities and higher rates of several diseases. U.S. veterans receive some limited compensation from the U.S. government, but very little, if any, assistance has been given to the Vietnamese people, the intended targets of the defoliant Agent Orange. The Victims of Agent Orange Relief Act of 2023 will be introduced in the House of Representatives by California Representative Barbara Lee. If passed, the bill would increase benefits to children of veterans exposed to Agent Orange. It would also expand research about Agent Orange and its effects on the health of exposed individuals, and provide medical, housing, and poverty reduction aid to Vietnamese people and their children affected by exposure. And it would help to clean up the many remaining dioxin hotspots in Vietnam. Paul Cox served in the U.S. Marines during the Vietnam War. He now serves on the board of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign, a project of Veterans for Peace, on whose board Paul also sits. We are fortunate to have Paul with us today to discuss the horrific legacy of what the Vietnamese people call the American War, as well as the campaign to provide compensation for the victims of Agent Orange. Paul, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
When did you serve in Vietnam, and what made you join Veterans for Peace and the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign?
I joined the Marines for 4 years and spent 18 months as a grunt in Vietnam through 1969 and half of 1970. I went to Vietnam supporting the war, but I left quite disillusioned and angry at what my country was doing to the Vietnamese and at myself for not paying closer attention prior to my joining the military. Ever since, I've worked to end first the Vietnam War and then all other subsequent wars that the U.S. had started. When Veterans for Peace started, I joined soon after and then have been active ever since. And the Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign came along in 2005 in support of a lawsuit, which I'll talk about later, by the Vietnamese Association of Victims of Agent Orange.
Paul, did the U.S. government know that dioxin causes birth defects while it was spraying Agent Orange on Vietnam? And when and why did they eventually discontinue the use of Agent Orange?
Well, of course the U.S. government knew. South Vietnamese doctors started complaining to the U.S. military, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations by 1965, that they were seeing a massive increase in miscarriages, stillbirth, and birth defects among women in South Vietnam's countryside. The U.S., of course, dismissed that as simple propaganda. But also in 1965, Dow Chemical Company, one of the creators of Agent Orange, the biggest one actually, held a meeting of all the herbicide producers in Midland, Michigan to discuss what to do about the introduction of dioxin into the herbicides due to sped up manufacturing. If a batch was cooked slowly at a lower temperature, the chemical reactions could be completed without any dioxin introduced. But at that point, the U.S. had issued open-ended contracts for all the Agent Orange that companies could supply, so they were cooking the batches very quickly and were finding increased levels of dioxin. After their discussion, though, in Michigan, they decided to do nothing. After all, only the enemy would be affected, and what do we care for them? Also, as early as 1964, scientists from around the world had started to question about the use of herbicides, and the noise from the scientific community and then concerned citizens got louder over the years. Finally, in 1969, after Nader's Raiders leaked a secret 1965 report by the Bionetics Lab that found that strong evidence of birth defects from one of the chemicals in Agent Orange, it sealed the doom of the ranch hand spraying program in Vietnam, and Nixon finally canceled it in December of 1970.
The Department of Veterans Affairs recognizes 16 diseases and illnesses associated with the spraying and use of Agent Orange by the U.S. military during the Vietnam era. What are those diseases and illnesses?
I came somewhat late to the Agent Orange issue after many thousands of U.S. Vietnam veterans had struggled for recognition of the damage that Agent Orange had done to their health and to that of some of their children. The first victory in that struggle was in 1984 when a class action lawsuit settled for $180 million against the chemical companies that knowingly manufactured the dioxin-contaminated herbicides. That money was paid out over 12 years to the veterans whose health had been damaged by their exposure, but it did not help veterans who got sick after the filing deadline or their affected children. So subsequently, Congress finally recognized the severity of the issue and in 1991 passed the Agent Orange Act, which over the years has resulted in the VA accepting a long list of diseases in U.S. veterans presumed to be the result of their exposure to herbicides. At this time, the VA is providing medical care and disability payments to several hundred thousand Vietnam veterans. We don't know the exact number because the VA is not tracking it in a way that we can use. And I won't list the 16 diseases that the VA has accepted as presumptive, but they're all really available and readily available at the VA.gov website. As of 2022, recent congressional action, the most recent two conditions were added, which are hypertension or high blood pressure, and a weird one known as MGUS, monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. Don't know what that's about. The legislation known as the PACT Act also expanded eligibility for veterans that were stationed in new locations throughout the empire when Agent Orange was sprayed. Lastly, for the first time, the PACT Act recognized the health effects of burn pits, which is the more recent war's major toxic exposure, and for veterans exposed to radiation. As for dioxin, it's a cell disruptor with very broad effects. At this time, the covered diseases among people directly exposed range from many kinds of tissue cancers, blood cancers like leukemia, to neurological degeneration such as Hodgkin's and the like. Is this list complete? Probably not, but it's a pretty substantial list.
From what you've just described, it seems that veterans are and their families are finally getting some relief, although too little too late. We also know there are hot spots still in Vietnam. Can you explain what these hot spots are, how many there are, and has the U.S. government contributed anything to cleaning them up? And can you tell us what more needs to be done?
Sure. You know, the U.S., of course, has responsibility to care for its war veterans. While the struggle for recognition of Agent Orange issues for veterans is not over, it's pretty far along. I came late to the AO issue, the Agent Orange issue, but since then I have concentrated mostly on the ongoing problems due to Agent Orange spraying in Vietnam. It is one of the two major legacies of the war that continue to do serious damage to affected Vietnamese. The other one is unexploded ordnance. But one of the major problems with the Agent Orange legacy is that of areas where there continues to be dioxin contamination in the environment, and those are known as hotspots. There may be 30 or 40 of them, not quite sure. Around 20 have been identified, and all of those are on land of former U.S. and South Vietnamese bases where it was sprayed into the perimeter wire to keep the weeds down. But the three main hotspots, the big ones, were the air bases that housed the Air Force Operation Ranch Hand spray units. And the storage, leakage, loading, washdown of the planes in those bases caused large quantities of the herbicides to wash into the surrounding land and waterways. That contamination has caused very severe damage to the citizens in which those air bases were placed. The smallest of the three major hotspots was Phu Cat in what was then central South Vietnam. The contaminated volume of soil was small enough that it was gathered up into a lined containment pit, capped and isolated. Remediation there is pretty much complete, and nothing is contemplated for further work. The second hotspot was Da Nang Airport, which is in the heart of Da Nang City, and where about 94,000 cubic meters of contaminated soil was put into a large concrete reservoir, electric heating rods driven into the pile and heated to more than 300 degrees centigrade, which is the temperature you need to destroy the dioxin. That remediation was completed in 2018 for a cost of U.S. to the United States for more than $150 million. The contamination in the last of the three hotspots is in Benoit, at the Benoit Airport, which is a large city just outside of Ho Chi Minh City. It is at least three times the size of Da Nang's contamination and will require about 10 years and perhaps $1 billion to completely repair. The U.S. has finally stepped into these three areas and is committed to completing them, but currently says it will be finished after Benoit is cleaned up. This will leave a couple of dozen much smaller hotspots, but those are the ones that can still do damage to the local communities that use or need to use that land.
These hotspots poison the water and the crops of Vietnam, which leads many experts to call what the U.S. military did in Vietnam the crime of ecocide. What about the lawsuit filed by the Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange? What happened in that lawsuit?
Yeah, well, the one in 1979 that completed in 1984 for $180 million can be considered kind of a partial success in that the chemical companies stepped up. But no veteran in that suit received more than about $5,100, and any veteran not in that suit got nothing. In addition, as a condition of the settling of that lawsuit, the chemical companies got a promise from the court they would never have to pay any more. And that has been pretty much the story ever since. So there have been a few other suits against the chemical companies, but they've all died quickly because of that settlement and that restriction. And the main one that you referred to was the Vietnamese Association of Victims of Agent Orange, VAVA, who sued in the companies in 2004. But it was dismissed in district court and appeals court, and the Supreme Court refused to reconsider. Suits by veterans who were not sick when the first suit settled received the same disgusting results. And by the way, veterans can't sue the U.S. government due to a longstanding decision by the Supreme Court known as the Ferris Doctrine that says that once your body is owned by the military, you have no legal recourse for damage it suffered. So the VAVA suit, which was huge, was the only one brought by people who aren't American citizens against the chemical companies, but it appears that there's really no recourse against the chemical companies for the damage that they consciously did to many, 4.8 million people.
Paul, it's truly outrageous the way the U.S. government has responded to this disaster. You've explained how at least some victims have been somewhat compensated, only those who were in the U.S. military. Can you tell us a little whether there's any distinction that's being made between female and male veterans when it comes to the type of compensation that is being allowed here?
In terms of the veterans themselves, there's no real distinction. I mean, a female veteran, of which there were only about 6,000, in the military who served in Vietnam, and male veterans, if they have any of the diseases and disorders that are presumed to be related to Agent Orange exposure, they get the same compensation and care. However, the children of those two groups are treated very differently. The children of male veterans who were born with spina bifida used to be recognized as a result of their father's presumed exposure. But the VA just this year dropped that recognition, so now there are no conditions in the children, no birth-related conditions in the children of male veterans that are recognized. However, in 2000, the children of female Vietnam War veterans were recognized for about 20 birth defects, and that's an open-ended list. It says there may be others. And these 20 birth defects are presumed to be the result of their mother's service in Vietnam and exposure to Agent Orange. But that long list of a small population will not change since any female veterans of the war are long past childbearing age. In addition, while the VA recognizes an array of birth defects in that population, their program is extremely thin and poorly organized, and it really doesn't amount to much for those children of female veterans who are covered. They don't get much for it.
Paul, You've explained the damages recovery cap that some of the veterans were entitled to receive, the $5,100. Can you explain how these children who have been diagnosed with these birth defects are being compensated?
Sure. The $5,100 had to do with the lawsuit against the chemical companies. Since 2000, the VA, the government agency that helps the Veterans Health Administration that helps veterans, has recognized those birth defects. So it's not really related to the $5,100. What they do get is they sometimes get a stipend of a couple of $100 a month. They ostensibly get medical care, but that medical care is often not available even at the VA or from any other source. Most of them are basically ignored by the VA unless they have been able to break through that crust that's known as a bureaucracy. I don't have a whole lot more information about that particular aspect, but I have heard a number of cases where the children of female veterans who have birth defects are really not given much respect and certainly not much help.
I, Marjorie Cohn, and my co-host Julie Hurwitz are speaking with Paul Cox from the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Have the Vietnamese and Vietnamese American victims received any compensation?
Well, in terms of the Vietnamese, I mean, certainly the U.S. has stepped up in terms of remediation under the rubric of do no further harm, you know, by cleaning up the mess that's still left. But it's really done bupkis for the perhaps 3 million Vietnamese whose health has been damaged by their exposure during the war or during the many decades afterwards. Vietnamese Americans also have not been recognized as being victims of the spraying, even though they and their children were in that country during those 10 years of spraying and for 4 or 5 years, 10 years afterwards, after the end of the war, before they moved to the United States. So there's certainly issues within the Vietnamese-American community, but we don't really know what those are in any detail. There's never been a public health study done of the Vietnamese-American victims or population to see which ones may be victims of exposure and what kind of diseases they might have. And the Vietnamese have really gotten very little. The long list of diseases and conditions in U.S. veterans and those birth defects in the children of female veterans, however, is quite useful in making the case that the U.S. also has responsibility to those victims of corporate greed and governmental violence. In the last few years, various U.S. officials have started talking more about helping the handicapped in Vietnam, quote, without regard to cause, unquote, but they've yet to put any real significant money where their guns are. There are many honest and effective nonprofit NGOs in Vietnam that could use a million here and a million there, but most of the dribs and drabs that are sent through USAID are given to the United States Beltway bandits stationed within the Beltway in D.C. that don't know and maybe don't care how to help the Vietnamese driven into poverty and pain by their disabilities. And so that needs to change, and the U.S. really needs to step up and provide real assistance to Vietnamese agencies that are helping people on the ground in Vietnam. And similarly for Vietnamese Americans, the U.S. needs to pay for a public health study of that entire population.
So there's this bill that's been introduced by Representative Barbara Lee, the Victims of Agent Orange Relief Act of 2023. That we'd love to hear you explain what would be provided if this bill were passed, and tell us a little bit about who else is supporting it, how many co-sponsors does it have, and how would this bill change the things that you're talking about here today?
Actually, the bill has not been introduced in the 117th Congress. But it will be soon by Congresswoman Lee. We're hoping by the end of the year it will have been reintroduced. It will be similar, however, to the last bill in the 116th Congress. People can look up if they care to. It's H.R. 3518, the Victims of Agent Orange Relief Act of 2021, and that's H.R. 3518, and you can look that up online. That bill has five clear elements. First, it provides health care and social services for Vietnamese affected by Agent Orange. It provides medical assistance and disability benefits to the affected children of American Vietnam veterans. It basically means for those children of male veterans that have birth defects should get the same consideration as the children of female veterans. And the assistance given to both sets of children should be vastly improved. The third item is provide health care for the affected Vietnamese Americans and their offspring. The fourth item is clean up the lands and restore the ecosystems contaminated by Agent Orange and dioxin in Vietnam. And that would include, you know, in addition to the three hotspots, which the U.S. is doing really tremendous work with, but also continue to provide assistance to cleaning up of those smaller hotspots that are scattered around what used to be South Vietnam. And the fifth item is to conduct research into the health effects of Agent Orange in the U.S. and Vietnam. From 1991 until 2018, there were about seven, I believe, maybe eight Agent Orange updates that the VA paid for through the Institute for Medicine. And those are completed now. There's not going to be any more unless Congress steps up and funds some additional research. And that needs to happen because science continues to move on, and we can learn a lot about, say, the genetic problems that dioxin can cause and maybe, you know, cause the second, third, and fourth generation problems. And that needs to be answered, and science is just now getting to the point where it might be able to do that.
How can our listeners support this important bill?
Well, first of all, let your congressperson know that they will be getting a Dear Colleague letter from Congresswoman Barbara Lee asking them to co-sponsor the bill, and that you expect them to co-sponsor that bill. And that will be the Agent Orange Relief Act of 2023, sometime before the end of the year. That's the first thing they can do. The other thing is to continue to educate themselves about, you know, how Agent Orange works and how other toxics work. You know, the U.S. military has never given a hoot about how it contaminates the land that it's on, the battlefields that it contaminates, both with toxic chemicals and with ordnance that doesn't explode. And that has an effect that goes for the last time of the veteran that was in that, exposed to that stuff, and also their children and their families.
Paul, this is such important work that you're doing, and it's an issue that continues to need to be brought to our attention. What else can our listeners do to bring attention to this shameful legacy of the Vietnam era?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, get involved with your local veterans organization. If you're a veteran, get involved with the Agent Orange issue and burn pits issue and like are really just special cases of the damage that is being done by, quote, civilization through, you know, chemical warfare and warfare itself throughout the world. So, you know, get involved in the environmentally conscious organizations in your community and keep Agent Orange in mind when you're fighting GMOs or pollution of the waterways and those sorts of things, because it's everywhere. And it was used, you know, Agent Orange and variations on that have been used throughout the country. That needs to be exposed too. Even if you're not a veteran, your community was affected by these toxic chemicals that are so widely used, and they're really just out there to increase profits for the chemical companies.
In the interest of full disclosure, Paul and I have worked together for many years in the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Paul, can you tell our listeners how to get to our website where they can read much more information about Agent Orange?
Sure. The Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign, our website is at www.vn-agentorange.org. That is VN, short for Vietnam, VN-agentorange.org.
Well, thank you so much, Paul Cox, for helping our listeners understand this ongoing and shameful legacy of the U.S. destruction of the people and land of Vietnam all these years later. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much. I very much appreciated being able to speak with you.
And we truly appreciate the work that you have been doing for all these years, and we hope that you keep continuing to do it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present journalist and author Sasha Abramski, who explains why democracy itself hangs in the balance as Donald Trump faces federal criminal charges for his attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Nadine Fareed Johnson of PEN America, who discusses the goals of her group's federal lawsuit against unconstitutional book bans raids carried out by Florida's Escambia County School District. And Tim Rowland, a freelance reporter, who talks about the shortage of affordable housing in New York State's Adirondack Park, an echo of the parallel housing crisis across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human Rights Watch reports that Malian soldiers and foreign fighters, identified as members of the Russia-linked Wagner Group, have committed executions and forced disappearances of dozens of civilians in the African nation of Mali since December 2022, according to the Intercept news site. Researchers found that the longtime U.S.-backed Malian military also tortured detainees in an army camp and destroyed and looted civilian property as part of its protracted campaign against militant Islamists. In December 2021, the Malian junta reportedly authorized the deployment of Wagner mercenary forces to fight Islamist militants after close to two decades of failed Western-backed counterterrorism campaigns in exchange for almost $11 million per month, as well as access to gold and uranium mines. U.S.-trained military officers have also repeatedly conducted coups, including the leader who toppled Mali's governments in 2020 and 2021. While the coups triggered restrictions on U.S. aid, Pentagon officials have pointed to Wagner's growing influence across Africa as a rationale to keep U.S. money flowing to Mali's coup government. China is far ahead of the U.S. in the extraction and processing of rare earth metals used in critical military applications like the F-35 fighter jet and green energy technology such as electric vehicles. Washington has repeatedly attempted to restart its rare earth mining program, but thus far has failed to make a dent in China's dominance in the processing of these metals over the last 40 years. The West's push to develop independent supplies of critical minerals took on greater urgency after Beijing imposed export controls last month on the strategic metals gallium and germanium, raising global fears that China could soon block exports of rare earth metals or processing technology. Reuters reports that technical complexities, partnership strains, and pollution concerns are hampering Western companies' ability to wrest market share away from China, which, according to the International Energy Agency, controls 87% of global rare earth minerals refining capacity. A year ago, 8,000 Amazon warehouse workers in Staten Island, New York, won a historic labor movement victory for the newly formed Amazon Labor Union. However, Amazon has never recognized the independent union, and ALU elections to unionize other Amazon facilities have been unsuccessful so far. The National Labor Relations Board recently filed a complaint against Amazon for failing to bargain with the union. In These Times magazine reports that its frustration has grown at the Staten Island warehouse, an 80-member reform caucus was organized and filed a lawsuit in federal court to reform the union's constitution and hold new elections for officers. Labor activist Bill Fletcher Jr. attempted to mediate between the two sides, but Fletcher's effort failed, writing a letter declaring it's clear the ALU's leadership must be reorganized and reaffirmed by the membership. Connor Spence, a co-founder of the union and its former treasurer, argues that in order to do the kind of organizing necessary to take on Amazon and get a strong contract, democracy is key. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Disgraced former President Donald Trump was indicted by Special Counsel Jack Smith on new federal criminal charges on August 1st. Based on his alleged role leading a multi-pronged attempt to stay in power after losing the 2020 presidential election to Joe Biden, the The alleged scheme included a conspiracy to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to stop the Electoral College vote count confirming the election result, enlisting fake Republican Party electors in seven states, and exploiting the violent January 6 coup attempt that killed five people and injured hundreds of Capitol Police officers. Trump was indicted on four criminal counts: conspiracy to violate civil rights, conspiracy to defraud the government, the corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding, and a conspiracy to carry out such obstruction. Trump has now been indicted three times in just 4 months. That includes the adult film star hush money case and the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case that will presumably go to trial next year. It's expected that Trump will soon be indicted on additional charges in Fulton County, Georgia, related to his alleged criminal interference in the state of Georgia's 2020 election vote count. Your reporter spoke with Sasha Abramski, author and regular contributor to The Nation magazine, who explains why he believes U.S. democracy itself hangs in the balance as Donald Trump faces the most serious federal criminal charges leveled against him thus far.
I mean, if you look at what happened between the summer of 2020, when the polls turned against Trump and it was pretty clear that he was going to lose the election, and January 6, 2021, when he stood at the podium in Washington, D.C. and basically egged a mob to go down to the Capitol and, in a sense, try and overturn the election with as much violence as possible. If you look at that six-month period, day in and day out, Trump and his acolytes, the crazy lawyers that were surrounding him, the crazy political consultants that were surrounding him, the ever more extreme members of paramilitary groups and all these other organizations that came out of the woodwork to support Trump, all of these groups put together a conspiracy, essentially, to keep Trump in office, even if the public voted him out of office. And this is extraordinary. I mean, Trump did many, many extraordinary things as president, many, many rule-breaking, norm-shattering things. But the idea that a president of the United States would essentially put his own personal ego before the durability of the republic, this is unheard of. And we saw what happened. We saw that people lost their lives. We saw that the Capitol building was violated. We saw the most extreme levels of intimidation and coercion being used against elections officials, from Brett Raffensperger in Georgia through to the Secretary of State in Arizona and so on. And ultimately, we saw a mob rampaging through the Capitol trying to hang the Vice President of the United States. You couldn't make this stuff up. And Trump has avoided justice for years and years and years, both on this charge and then all the other illegalities and sordid behaviors that characterized his adult life. And it's now finally catching up with him. And you talked about all the indictments in the introduction to the program. You talked about all the indictments he's now facing. These are serious charges. This isn't sort of some Mickey Mouse game where he's going to get a slap on the wrist if he's convicted. This is a president or an ex-president of the United States who faces the very, very real prospect of significant time in prison because of rampant illegality. And I think it's a long, long time coming. This process now has to play itself out. But, you know, when Trump says that this is a political witch hunt, don't buy this for a moment. He was arraigned by a grand jury. He's going to face a trial by jury of his peers. He's going to have all of the opportunities to mount a credible defense. There's no witch trial involved here. This is just a long overdue comeuppance. This is a long overdue process of justice playing out for Donald Trump.
Sasha, from the perspective of someone originally from the UK, what does this spectacle look like? The support for Trump and America's deeply flawed democracy, where an electoral college instead of direct popular vote is what determines who sits in the White House. And then, of course, we have all the mechanisms Republicans have employed to suppress the vote, including partisan gerrymandering, designed to disenfranchise millions of Americans, primarily communities of color. You grew up in another system, the parliamentary system in Great Britain, but I know you talk to people from around the world. What does this spectacle look like?
When I go around the world and I talk to people, and I do travel a lot, and I talk to a lot of people, both in the world of politics and then just more generally, people I meet, you know, in different areas of the world, there is a sense of bemusement that someone like Donald Trump could be a viable candidate. There was a sense of bemusement about it in 2016, there was a deep fear of his re-election in 2020 because it was clear by then that, you know, he was no Silvio Berlusconi type. He was way more dangerous. He wasn't just this clown with a lot of money who'd bought his way into office. He was a clown with a lot of money who was extremely powerful as a demagogue. And I think, you know, fast forward to today and to the upcoming election, there is just a horror out there that this man is even remotely competitive because he's shown how dangerous he is. And he's shown what damage he can do to the American democratic fabric. And people overseas realize that. You know, sometimes it's healthy to take a step back. And, you know, when you're in the sort of chaos of America from the inside, you know, we see the chaos, but we maybe don't see the full implications of it. But when you step out and you look at America from a distance and you see this great, you know, you mentioned it's flawed. It is flawed, but it's also a great democracy. And when you see this great democracy floundering, and you see the way in which millions and millions of people are buying into a personality cult around Donald Trump, well, that's horrifying because America has such extraordinary clout on the world stage. It is so dominant. It's so important militarily, economically, diplomatically. You name it, America's important. And if America goes off the rails, if it has a sort of collective nervous breakdown around Donald Trump, well, that makes life in America messier, but it also makes life globally messier. And I think that's something that we don't always think about, that the choices we make in this country, by virtue of how powerful this country is, those choices matter to 8 billion people around the world. And the idea that Trump could end up again as the most powerful human being on earth on a vengeance mission, I mean, that's horrifying. That's got to be horrifying for people of all political ideologies all around the world at this point.
That was Sasha Abramsky, author and regular contributor to The Nation magazine. Find a link to his recent article titled "The Latest Trump Indictment is the One That Really Counts" and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump faces multiple serious criminal indictments as he battles 12 other candidates to win the Republican Party's presidential nomination. But another battle is being waged across the country in advance of the 2024 election. Under the guise of parental rights, right-wing Republicans and other extremist groups have descended on school boards, city council meetings, and political forums to demand the banning of books in public schools and libraries, as well as the censorship of history and literature in school curricula. Targets of the GOP culture war's repressive campaign are books mostly dealing with the issues of race, gender, and sexuality, focused mainly on LGBTQ themes. When it comes to the teaching of U.S. history, many of these same groups demand the censorship of curricula, dealing with America's slave-era past, Jim Crow discriminatory laws, contemporary structural racism, and inequality. While pro-democracy parents groups rally to defend free public schools across the nation, the group PEN America, along with publisher Penguin Random House, authors and parents of children affected by book bans, filed a lawsuit in federal court on May 17th asking for books banned by Florida's Escambia County School District to be returned to school library shelves. Your reporter spoke with Nadine Fareed Johnson, managing director of PEN America's Washington office, who explains the goals of the lawsuit and the larger fight being waged nationwide against censorship and the suppression of free speech.
So Escambia County is really at the forefront of much of the book banning that we've seen, not only in Florida, but around the country. When the Escambia County School Board began to remove books from school libraries, they did so because the books addressed issues of race and racism and LGBTQ plus identities. And so PEN America joined with Penguin Random House and with authors and parents and students to file suit to contest these book bans as being unconstitutional.
Describe a bit about what kinds of books are being banned, how these decisions are being made, and the crux of the matter in terms of why you believe this to be unconstitutional.
Absolutely. So what we're seeing in terms of being banned, as I mentioned, most of the books focus on issues of race, racism, and LGBTQ plus identities. There are hundreds of books that have been challenged. I can give you a few names of ones that have been banned or restricted in some way. We have All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson, who we are privileged to have as a fellow plaintiff, Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, A Court of Mist and Fury by Sarah Moss, Draw Me a Star by Eric Carle, Empire of Storms by Sarah Moss, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. The list just goes on. And what we've seen here is actually a pretty calculated attempt by actually one individual in the district who began to file complaints a little over a year and a half ago. I think it was about in the spring of 2022. And she would file challenges to the books. Now, Escambia County actually had a process. When I talk about the county, I'm talking about the school district. They actually had a process by which book challenges were reviewed. They were taken under consideration, and then a committee would come forth and state whether they believe the challenge should be upheld or not. And in this case, what we found was that even though the committee that was charged with reviewing the challenges was coming back and saying the challenges should not be upheld, the district was nevertheless choosing to remove or otherwise restrict access to the books. And so ultimately our decision to sue was based on, as I mentioned, it was based on the Constitution. We filed First Amendment and 14th Amendment causes of action, turning to not only the right to receive information, which is part of the rights of the First Amendment and that inured to the benefit of the students, but also we wanted to point out the viewpoint discrimination that was happening with respect to these books. Because what we know from Supreme Court jurisprudence, Scott, is that school administrators do have significant discretion to determine the content of what's in the school library, but they cannot exercise that discretion in a manner that is deemed to be political or partisan. And so what that means in practice is that the First Amendment bars a school district from removing books from school libraries or restricting access to them based on a political or ideological disagreement with the ideas in the books, and that's what we're seeing happening in Escambia County.
Nadine, how widespread are the pattern of book banning across the country, primarily in Republican districts, Republican school districts, and Republican states? You know, I've heard a lot of anecdotal information about book bannings here and there and everywhere, but I'm sure PEN America has looked into the kind of hard numbers. What are we talking about when we're talking about the book banning that seems to have taken hold of the Republican Party?
So I want to share this in a way that I hope really speaks to the depth and breadth of what we are seeing here. We are talking about over 4 million students in the U.S. who are affected by these bans. It has happened in 37 different states. So while you are correct that there has been, most of these bans are based in a particular type of ideology, we are really seeing it happening all across the country, in different pockets all across the country. We have calculated now in the last school year, well, I guess in the 2021-2020 school year, we found over 2,500 instances of book bans taking place that affected over 1,600 titles. So if you're thinking about this in terms of just the numbers of people who are affected, I mentioned the 4 million students. Obviously, their parents are also affected. The authors are affected, and the translators to some of these books are affected when there's translation at stake. The artists that are providing their material for the books, it really does affect not only, again, the right to receive this information, but also the livelihoods and the ability of these authors, translators, and artists to be able to share their work. And, of course, that's not even touching upon the teachers and school librarians whose professional opinions are being disregarded in this fever to ban books across the country and their ability to actually engage in the pedagogical work that they are seeking to do with the students. We've been very, very steeped in this. We have been following the data, doing the research, and providing information for people. We have resources on our website for librarians, for writers, for others who are interested in getting involved. And we would encourage you to do so, and we thank you.
That was Nadine Fareed Johnson, Managing Director of PEN America's Washington office. Learn more about the PEN America and Penguin Random House federal lawsuit against book banning in Florida's Escambia County schools by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Finding decent, affordable housing in the U.S. has become ever more difficult in the 21st century. Inside New York State's 6-million-acre Adirondack Park, three times larger than Yellowstone, many rental cottages have been converted to condominiums, and a large number of private homes or apartments have been converted to Airbnb and VRBO short-term rentals. Options for vacationers are now limited to booking standard hotel rooms or using one of the short-term vacation rental websites. These changes in the real estate market, enabled by digital platforms, have exerted increasing pressure on local residents' ability to either buy or rent property inside the boundaries of the park, which is protected by the New York State Constitution as forever wild and free. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who is vacationing in the Adirondacks, spoke with Tim Rowland, a freelance reporter based in the area, who is writing a multi-part series on the housing crisis for Adirondack Explorer magazine. Here he explains that during the COVID pandemic, outsiders were bidding up property values, buying property up with cash sight unseen, wreaking havoc on the local real estate market. He also talks about recent developments that could lead to possible solutions.
Housing has always been kind of a touchy situation in the Adirondacks. The housing shortage, such as it is not really new. You know, it's always been vacation homes and a certain competition between inside people who, you know, have lived here all their lives and outside people coming in and buying up the housing stock. What has happened in the Adirondacks very closely parallels what has happened throughout the country. So in that respect, we're not any different from the shortages and the price escalation that's happened in other parts of the country. What sets the Adirondacks apart is our inability for the market to meet this new demand. The land is, of course, very tightly regulated by the state. And, of course, I think most people would agree, rightly so, they want to protect the wilderness. But that means you can't go out and just lay out a big subdivision and build a bunch of homes. Beyond that, the topography doesn't lend itself to housing developments. The land is very steep. The valleys are very narrow. It's hard to find any place that's flat that doesn't flood. And so there's just a lot of different problems in terms of addressing this shortage.
We've been talking about buying homes mostly, but what about renting? Have they been able to rent, or are they also priced out?
That market is, you know, you can't say it's gone, but it's getting that way. Two things have happened. One, a lot of the long-term rental properties have been turned into what they call short-term rentals, which are basically just that. They're people who stay for a week or a weekend. And the benefits to that for the landlord are twofold. One, it's a lot more lucrative. You can probably make 2-3 times the amount of money renting it out on a weekly basis as you can just renting it by the month. And two, the Airbnb clients tend to be fairly well screened, so you don't have a lot of the problems that you might have with getting a bad tenant. And so long-term rentals tend to be a lot more challenging in that respect. So what happened, you had a lot of these long-term rentals being converted to short-term rentals, and people who are not eligible to buy a house, and there are a lot of them because they don't have the credit, perhaps, or they don't have the money, have been forced to move to the fringes of the park or the fringes of the population centers. So you have people that are commuting, you know, 45 minutes or an hour by car to get to their jobs. There's very little in the way of public transportation here. That compounds their problems because, you know, these are people working for low wages who have trouble affording not just housing, but also gasoline and their transportation costs.
You were talking in one of the articles I read about solutions, which, you know, I think probably don't really affect that many people, but can you talk a little bit about that?
The market economy is not able to do this on its own. I think that's, you know, everybody tends to agree. So you need some kind of economic tailwind. You need either donated land, or you need free septic, or you need some assistance with down payments. And there are various organizations, some government, some nonprofit, and some just private people who have donated land. So you have a lot of people who are trying to reduce the costs in any way they can. And so what you're finding is that a municipality may buy a chunk of land at below market rate from someone who is interested in just being helpful. And so the town will take that, they will put a sewer and water system on it, and then build the homes and sell to people who maybe could afford the price of the home, but not the price of the land, the price of the septic, the price of the all these other things that go along with it and make homes more expensive. You know, there's no such thing, obviously, as free housing, but there are ways to cut around the edges and make the housing a little more affordable. And that's what you see a lot of the nonprofits and municipalities and philanthropists trying to do.
That was Tim Rowland, a freelance journalist who's writing a multi-part series on the housing crisis in New York State's Adirondack Park. Learn more about the shortage of affordable housing in the Adirondacks and across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, FRSC in Santa Cruz, California, REC Delmarva FM in Riverton, Maryland, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.